Hello and welcome back to this episode of Conversations at Jackrabbit Slims. And this week I am joined by Paul Shirey from the Arctic Ninja Network. Paul, welcome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's very cool to have you on the show. I always love making these connections, and Armando, who was a guest a couple episodes ago, sort of spurred this. He dropped a quote about Pulp Fiction, which you replied to, and then I jumped in and said, hey, you know, how about you be a guest on my show? But we'll get to Pulp Fiction in a minute, Paul. I want to talk about your network and what you do.
Sure. So I was the editor-in-chief of Jovelo.com, the movie news site, for about 8 years. And then last year, I left that position to basically pursue other options, other things that I've been trying to get off the ground. So now I'm working on a graphic novel, and I also run the Arctic Ninja Network on YouTube, which is, you know, just a new startup YouTube channel that I began, which does commentaries, movie commentaries, unboxings. I'm getting ready to unveil a bunch of other new content that I think is going to be really fun for everybody. So I'm just trying to branch out and really just embrace my creative avenues. And I kind of started to lose that with Joblo. It just kind of became more of a managerial kind of job. And
sure,
I just wanted more. And I just got a lot of creative juices flowing, and I just need to feed that beast. So that's pretty much where I am now, is just making comics and making videos at this point.
Excellent, excellent. And the best way for people to find you is on the YouTube channel there?
You can find me on YouTube. That's the Arctic Ninja Network. Just type that in, you'll find me. And then if you want to follow me on Twitter, that's at Arctic Ninja Paul. Twitter is kind of a cesspool, but I do have, you know, a fairly big audience that I communicate with people there, and quite a few people that I enjoy communicating. And that's obviously where we linked up. So
yeah,
it does serve its purposes and frustrations at the same time, but that is another good place to at least find me if you so desire.
Excellent. I'll include links to both of those, the YouTube and the Twitter, in the show notes.
Very cool.
And I got to say, you know, for me, Twitter is what you make of it. And you're able to sort of tailor your experience by muting and, you know, mainly muting keywords and people that you really don't want to interact with. So for me, you know, I think I've created a pretty good Twitter experience for myself. And
that's amazing. You need to write a book on that. That needs to be shared with the world. I want to read it as well. Because Twitter is... Oh my God. I don't even want to go on a Twitter rant, because it is what it is. Twitter is this animal. It's like a curse that I have, really. It's like, it's a great place for me to engage with people. And it's also a great place to rile me up. And like, I just see, you know, so many awful takes and terrible takes. And sometimes I give bad takes, and it's just like, oh man, how did this happen to all of us? How did Twitter happen to us? It's just crazy. So yeah. But I'm glad you've been able to make it work for you. That's good.
I think the main thing with social media in general, Paul, is that I think it gave a voice to everyone. And that's good, but it's also bad, because you have to, you know, sort of work your way through a lot of, you know, shit to find, you know, if you will, the cream of the crop. And, you know, it happened with film and music as well. I mean, everybody, and podcasts, everybody's got a podcast now.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's able to, you know, sort of be, you know, creative. I mean, I sort of came up in the 90s and, you know, had a partner that I sort of made short films with, and they all look and sound like shit. But in 2020, like what you can even just accomplish on an iPhone is like, if I went back in time, it's mind blowing. So it's kind of cool that everybody has a voice, but it's also kind of bad that everybody has a voice.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the other thing too, with like social media, is that it's brand new. Like so many people have, you know, they treat it like this thing that's been around forever and ever. Mm-hmm. This is a very new experience. And figuring out the best way to use it, the best way to communicate through it, is tenuous. It's just not an easy thing to really navigate, because the rules are just kind of made up as we go along, right? This week you can say this, the next week you can't. You know, this week that's offensive, this week that's not. And, you know, now this person's canceled. No, now this person's okay. It's nearly impossible to keep up with. And my hope is, and my general feeling really, is that we will get to a point where we'll kind of figure it out to some manageable way, right? To where you know what's okay and what's not, rather than it being this constantly evolving animal that can't be tamed. And that's what it is.
Yeah. Well, I also think the other thing is, like you said, it's such a young medium. I think we were all really naive that it was really sort of a shock when it became as politicized as it was.
Yeah.
I remember I first joined Twitter. It was just, you know, silly, fun place to go. Facebook was the same way. And then people realized that they could sort of weaponize it and make it a political tool. And I don't think anybody realized that was going to happen. And it was a really, really wild genie that got let out of the bottle.
Absolutely. Yeah. And people just abuse it on a regular basis in that sense. So I've really tried to just keep it fun, but you know, I'm someone that kind of just bites his tongue quite a bit, and just of late, I'm like, my tongue is bleeding now. I can't not say anything. If I'm going to be on this platform, I'm going to have to speak up on some of this stuff. I just can't play the middle ground all the time, which is what I was trying to do.
Yeah.
And that's where the conundrum comes with Twitter, is like, you have to kind of make a conscious decision. It's like, are you just going to kind of dabble, or are you going to let your voice be heard here? And you just have to kind of decide. And really, there's no wrong answer in that sense. There's nothing wrong with people just dabbling. It's probably the smarter way and the most, the way to stay the most sane. But if you're going to lean into it, then you got to lean into it. And that's just kind of what I decided of late. And, you know, it happens. You bleed followers when that happens initially, because they're like, whoa, what is this? This is not the content I came here for. And it's kind of like, well, you know, I've had to deal with a lot of crazy content on my daily basis with everybody else. So it's like, you know, now is a time that I feel like I have to speak up. So
sure.
But I mostly love talking about movies. Like, that's what I do. You know, I mean, movies, comics, art, pop culture, like, that's really my beat. But, you know, I'm not absent of having opinions on other things, too. But really, what I enjoy most about Twitter is things like this, where you meet people. You find, absolutely, hey, let's talk about Pulp Fiction, or hey, let's do a podcast, or I get to hear people talk about like what their favorite movies are, because I'm genuinely interested. Like, I love fellow fans. I love talking to fans of movies. I never considered myself above and beyond anybody. I've considered everybody in that same venue my peers.
Yeah.
And I just love talking movies with people. Like, I miss the days when I was in my early 20s. And like every Fridays before I was married, before I had a kid, before I had the responsibilities and everything I had, it's like Fridays, hey, dude, what movie are we going to see? And after the movie, we'd go get food. We'd go to, you know, Denny somewhere, anywhere, and talk about what we just saw. I truly miss those days. They don't exist right now. Certainly not with COVID.
Yeah.
And I miss it. I do miss it quite a bit. So wherever I can get those venues, like, this is a good night to feed that beast as well. So.
Absolutely. I'm so glad we were able to do this. So sort of taking us back to 1994, the fall of 1994, when Pulp Fiction came out. Do you want to talk a little bit about your first time seeing the movie, your awareness of it? And was that in 1994? Did you see it theatrically?
Absolutely. So I gotta roll back the clock a little bit. So I remember seeing the trailers for Reservoir Dogs on videos that I rented from Blockbuster. Like, there was no internet quite there. So I was like, dude, like, the internet had like just really kicked in, and I didn't even have it at my house at that point. But
yeah,
I'd seen the trailers for Reservoir Dogs. I was like, dude, what is this movie? It looks awesome. And so I finally saw it. I didn't know when it was coming out. I just knew it was coming out soon. And I saw it on the shelf and I was like, dude, I got to see this. And I ended up watching Reservoir Dogs back to back 4 times in a row, which is rare. I mean, that just doesn't really happen. Even in my younger days, like, just, you know, as a kid with no job, no responsibilities, just watching movies all the time, it's rare that I would plop in the same movie back to back. Like, first off, who has that kind of time as an adult where you have the time to watch a movie 4 times in a row?
Yeah.
But I was just mesmerized by what Tarantino had done. I've never seen a film like it. Even though, you know, it's basically a remake of a, I believe, a Hong Kong film.
Yeah. City on Fire.
Yeah. City on Fire. That's it. And I was like, dude, this is amazing. And I was just enthralled. So Tarantino made a fan right off the bat. I remembered his name right away. I was like, this guy. And I was just like, what is he doing next? And I still have the Entertainment Weekly, like, summer movie preview where it has the Pulp Fiction cast on the cover.
Oh, wow.
And I was just so excited for it. I was like, man. And at that point, you got to remember, most people hadn't really seen Reservoir Dogs.
No.
Like, they didn't. Like, we kind of assumed that Tarantino was just this massive star from the get-go. But Reservoir Dogs, like, didn't really play that much in theaters.
No.
I don't know how much it played in theaters at all. I didn't even see it in theaters. So a lot of people still hadn't discovered who Tarantino was or what he had to offer. So Pulp Fiction for a lot of people was probably their first foray into the world of Tarantino.
Yep. That was true for me. Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, I was like, dude, this is going to be amazing. And people are like, what is this, Pulp Fiction? It looks pretty good. It's got a good cast. I'm like, dude, you have no idea. It's directed by Quentin Tarantino. They're like, who? Like, to think of that today is insane. Like, everybody knows who Quentin Tarantino is. He's a household name, right?
Yeah.
But back then he wasn't. So I just remember being so excited and then seeing it. And I was just like, you know, just blown away by the structure. The cast, first off, is amazing. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, just Tarantino continuing to play with the same structure that he's done for all of his films, this, like, you know, jumping forward, backwards, sideways into the stories. I just love it. I'm here for it. Like, it's, I think some people probably get frustrated and they get confused and stuff like that. I think probably by now most people are caught up on how he makes films. But back then it was like, it just felt so vibrant and cool and original. And you're just like, man, this is so cool. And it kept your mind going, right?
Yeah.
You know, like the middle of the movie, John Travolta's killed. You're like, what happened? Yeah. Like, wait, Vincent Vega's dead? And I was like, even me, you know, who was nominally aware of Tarantino's methods, I was still like, wait, what? What, huh? Yeah. You know, and those are great. That's another great, well, spoilers for anybody listening that has to see Pulp, you're listening to a Pulp Fiction podcast. I would assume you know that Vincent Vega dies in the middle of the movie.
Yeah.
But that's just awesome. You know, like, that just doesn't happen in most mainstream films where you kill the protagonist in the middle of the film. And I guess we could argue about who the protagonist is. I always thought of it as Travolta. He's the only character that's in all the stories.
Well, and he was the one that was nominated for lead actor.
Yeah. Yeah. And listen, he's great. And it was a great role, like a comeback role for him. It's a great comeback role for Bruce Willis, you know, because he'd had a string of flops up to that point, but he was still bankable. Not like he is now.
Yeah.
But, you know, you had a lot of, like, just really great people show up, and quite a few of the Reservoir Dogs people as well. Mm-hmm. So for me, I was blown away. And then it just caught fire, right? Like, Pulp Fiction's theatrical release put Tarantino on the map. Reservoir Dogs was like, you know, lighting the fuse, and Pulp Fiction is the explosion. And it's just great. It's an absolute cinema classic. Actually, I have it playing in the background right now.
Excellent.
Just because I knew we were going to be, I watched it a couple weeks ago, and I love it. I love it so much. And it's one of those movies that you can put on anytime.
Oh.
You really, really can.
Yeah.
It's a movie that it's telling multiple stories that all overlap. So I feel like that's why it delivers on that rewatchability scale, because you feel like you're watching almost like three or four episodes of a TV series that all connect, right? It's like a binge watch in a way.
Yeah.
And I think that format really suits it quite well. And, you know, you get to see these characters kind of recur and pop in, and it's just fun.
Yeah.
Like, more than anything, it's fun. And that's what, you know, this is entertainment. We tend to forget that. We take this shit so seriously sometimes. But, you know, it's entertaining, and that's what it's supposed to be. And I really think Pulp Fiction checks all those blocks.
Yeah. And the other interesting thing is, you know, I see a lot of, you know, since I've started the show, especially, I've kind of tried to tune myself a little bit more in to how people have reacted to the film. And I think, and I hate to be that guy that says that, but it almost feels like you had to be there, because Pulp Fiction was a phenomenon. And I won't put it on the same level as like a Star Wars or anything like that, but this little indie film, and Miramax was indie, even though it had, I guess, Disney money behind it. But, you know, it was a $7 million picture that made over $100 million at the box office.
Yep.
You know, nowadays, $100 million, you know, lots of movies hit that milestone. But when Pulp Fiction did it, it was still a big deal. And I think, you know, people that sort of are critical of the film today that weren't there don't really realize sort of what a phenomenon it was.
And it made, you know, I mean, it sold like international rights, I think, for like 11 or 12 million.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was already in the green before it even hit theaters. Like, you know, this is like amazing stuff. And you see that every now and again, too. You see like a Blumhouse movie that was made for nothing and, you know, turns a massive profit. And, you know, what's funny is those movies tend to fill the coffers much better and much faster than your big budget movies. A lot of people don't realize that.
Oh yeah, because the overhead is so high on you know,
yeah.
You know, that's why they killed, Iron Man. You know, you can't give Robert Downey Jr. $50 million every time out of the gate.
They're like, Robert, seriously, you've topped out. You have to die. There is no Iron Man 4, bro. That's forget about it. The budget is basically paying you at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Robert Downey Jr. is not going to starve anytime soon.
No, not at all. But that is a really interesting point. And it's kind of a shame, Paul, that we've sort of reached the stage of blockbuster filmmaking. And I don't know if it's audiences that are to blame or if it's, you know, studios that are to blame or these multiplexes that have to have content that are to blame. But it seems like unless there's a 60 or 70 or 80 or $90 million budget, you know, people aren't going to be interested in seeing it.
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. But, you know, I would point to say, you know, HBO Max debuted The Little Things recently, which, you know, probably that's a mid-budget film. I didn't love it personally, but, you know, it's not a big blockbuster style movie. It does have Denzel Washington.
Yeah.
But, you know, Denzel, he's a different kind of appeal. He's a profit turner, but not like in huge, huge numbers, unless he's doing a specific type of film.
Right.
And, you know, I think that we still get, they're still out there. They're still being made, you know, the Way Back with Ben Affleck would be another example. You know, just there are smaller mid-budget movies that get out there. There's just less of them. And, you know, you don't really feel the risk or the ingenuity that you get with something like Pulp Fiction. So I just did Sundance. I did virtual Sundance. I watched 14 movies.
Oh, wow.
Which is crazy, but I was really excited to do it. And it was my first time being able to watch as many. I'd been in person for a couple years now, but doing it at home was actually easier.
Yeah.
So I watched 14 movies, but I can't say that any of them, none of them were like 5-star perfect films. Like, it was a diverse amount of films. There was a couple interesting ones, but nothing like a Pulp Fiction. Or even a Reservoir Dogs or anything like that.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And well, I think that's the one main thing that's sort of good about all these streaming options we have is it puts movies that you might not have the opportunity to see,
yes,
you know, in Minnesota, you know, isn't going to get an art house film. So that's the one thing I've really, really sort of enjoyed about, you know, and you can say what you want about, you know, the theatrical experience and the fact that it can never be replaced and it can't be replaced. But at the same time, you know, having access to stories, I think is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. I watched a movie on Netflix recently called The White Tiger and I was blown away. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was just a phenomenal movie. And it kind of has a Tarantino vibe in that sense. Like, it does jump around a little bit. It's got a really interesting narrative and it takes you into a world that, unless you're from India, you're probably not familiar with. So, you know, to me, I was like, man, this is great. And I had no plan. I like put it on as background noise one right. Saturday morning and I just got sucked in and, you know, I hadn't even heard of it. Like, I just saw that Netflix was featuring it when I opened up the front page. And I was like, I think I'd seen a tweet somewhere where someone was like, oh yeah, this movie's coming out. And I was like, I hadn't even seen a trailer. And I was like, screw it. I'll just put it on and see what it is. And I was like, dude, this is amazing. So as you said, you know, there are options and there are opportunities for these indie hits and these, you know, lesser known films to find an audience. And I think that's great. Honestly, I think that's one of the best things about streaming. I think we're going to see more and more films. You're just not going to see them promoted like we're used to, and yeah, you're not going to see them all in theaters. That's just the way it's going to be. So that's just kind of the rub, I guess. You know, a lot of us that grew up with the theatrical experience lament this whole COVID lockdown, streaming everything thing going on. But you also got to remember that there's a whole generation that's growing up with, you know, iPhones and tablets and YouTube, and they don't care.
Yeah.
Like, they like to go to the theater, but do they really give a shit? Like, does it really affect their life in such a way? They're like, this is absolutely terrible. But they're just like, I just watch at home. I mean, most people have a widescreen TV. I would say probably 55 inches or more at point. I mean, they're very, very affordable. I mean, you could take your COVID relief and go buy a massive TV and put it in your living room. So, you know, the thing for a lot of kids, and I say kids, but, you know, these are like 20-year-olds at this point that are like, they just don't care. Mm-hmm. It's not important to them. You know, it's important to me. And it's, maybe it's important to you.
Yeah.
But in the long haul, the model's going to change. That doesn't mean theaters are going to go away, but you know, people are just getting accustomed to this kind of streaming model of just watching movies at home, and everyone's going to have to adapt to that. And Hollywood is adapting. They absolutely adapting. So,
yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, having as many eyes as possible on your product isn't a bad thing.
No, not at all. And all these people subscribe, right? Like mm-hmm. I subscribe to HBO Max, got Amazon Prime, mm-hmm. got Disney Plus, I have Hulu. And I mean, you really don't have an excuse to like find nothing to watch anymore. I remember the early days of Netflix, they're like, oh, I don't even want to pay for it. There's like nothing on. I'm like, that excuse is done.
Yeah.
You know, like those, I mean, Pulp Fiction right now is on HBO Max. That's what I'm streaming it from. I'm just about to watch Butch kill Vince, and you know, the options to watch all these different movies from all different times, new, old, whatever, they're all there. So
yeah,
it's tough. It's gonna be tough for theaters to compete with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's hypothetically say you turn on your TV and Pulp Fiction's there. What scene do you hope you jump in on?
Oh, like if I just turn it on?
Yeah. Like, is there...
Ooh, that's a good question.
Yeah. Is there any particular scene you look forward to?
Damn, dude. That's a hard one. That's a good question, though. You have to give me a second here. You know, I'll say I really love the Butch and Marsalis in the pawn shop scene. Mm-hmm. The way that whole thing unfolds to me is just like, oh my God, you know, like that it starts like he's got his watch. He's happy. He's just killed Vincent.
Yeah.
He's about to flee. And then all of a sudden there's Marsalis and you know, there's a moment, right? Like he could have just driven away.
Yep.
He could have just driven away, but he makes a choice, right? He's like, I'm going to kill Marsalis. I'm going to hit him with this car. He could have just driven away, but he made that choice, and everything that unfolds from that moment just goes Twilight Zone, just as they played the music at the end of that sequence. Like it goes full Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
And I just love it. I'm just like, and the first time seeing it,
nobody could predict what was happening.
No way, man. You know, like I wish I could go back to experience that moment without knowing it now. Like that's somebody like in the future needs to invent this thing where you can like erase a movie from your brain and then rewatch it. So you can see it for the first time. Like that's like somebody needs to create that technology.
Yeah. Yeah.
Movie, like Total Recall or something.
Yeah. Like I remember I saw The Departed on opening night when The Departed came out.
Oh man!
And for anybody listening that hasn't seen The Departed, we're going to spoil that movie.
Spoilers. Everybody dies.
You know, that moment where Leo gets shot coming out of the elevator there was a moment that I was like, oh my God, that's a moment I want to experience again.
Yeah.
So the only way I was able to do that is the next day I went back to see the movie again. And I got to sort of just key in on the audience during that moment.
Yeah,
see how they
experience
react.
Experience it through everybody else. Yeah. Well, that's what it ultimately becomes, right? You know, that's what we do throughout our lives. Like, you know, us movie nerds is, you know, one of the greatest things is discovering a great movie and then showing it to a loved one or a friend and watching their expression. I used to really enjoy showing people Requiem for a Dream.
Right.
I mean, that was one of my favorite things. Like, oh man, once we get to the end, and I just love like that blank stare of shock that people have on their face after Requiem for a Dream. And I just like, I'm just smiling. I'm like, yeah, right. But that's the only way I can re-experience it. I can watch it by myself. And I'm just like looking around empty room and be like, yeah, right. It was messed up. It's so much better if you got some people there that you can also destroy their psyches with.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, you know, that, you know, you sort of talk about rewatching movies and, you know, you never get to re-experience that first time. And it's, you know, it's the same thing with songs or music or, you know, your favorite album. So it's kind of weird how your experience changes from the first time you see it. And there's a reason you go back to watch it again, because it connected with you in some way. But then you start peeling layers away and you start discovering other things about it that you love.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I've talked about this quite a bit on my other podcast, or my podcast, The Beard and the Bald. We experience movies differently throughout our lives. So you watch the Goonies at, say, age 10.
Yeah.
You are connecting with those kids. You are relating to those kids in that movie, right? That's what you're watching. You get into the sense of adventure. You place yourself there. You watch it again when you're a teenager, say 17, 18. It's another experience. You know, you're like, oh, you know, like you're watching it from Brand's point of view now. You're watching it from the older kids. And then you get older and maybe you have your own kids or maybe you don't, but now you're kind of like, man, if these were my kids,
yeah,
you know, what would I, you know, which one would be my kid? How would they behave? How would they deal with this situation? You know, or you're just experiencing it on a nostalgic sense and you're noticing different things that you're like, you know, oh, those effects look kind of crappier. Wow, I really do like this music or whatever the case may be. There's little things that you pick up on. And so many of those things change as you get older because of your life experience. You know, the way that your life goes is going to determine how you view the movies you watch over time. And that's one of the things that I love about film altogether is that it is an art form that changes with you throughout your life. Mm-hmm. That's an amazing thing. And to me, that's, you know, that's why I find movies just so, and just so drawn to them. That's why they've been a part of my life from the beginning. It's more than just 2 hours of entertainment. You know, it's so much more than that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because if I go back to 1994 and the kind of movies that I really, really enjoyed watching, some of those movies I don't really enjoy anymore, but, you know, Pulp Fiction has always stayed strong in terms of, you know, it's always been one of my go-to, you know, top five movies. So
yeah,
it's really interesting. And one thing that I am kind of curious about, since we're talking about nostalgia and how movies change as you get older, one thing about Pulp Fiction that's always sort of been, you know, interesting is by every indication, it takes place in the early 90s, but yeah, it doesn't overtly feel like the early 90s. You know, it's got hints of the 70s. It's got hints of the 50s and the 60s. Do you think that at all impacts the overall feeling of nostalgia you might get watching that movie?
Well, yeah. And the other thing, too, is that I think that's what helps make it a timeless film, because you're never quite sure mm-hmm. what the time frame is. And you settle into the film so easily that you'd never care.
Yeah.
So, you know, watching the movie right now, you know, one thing I just realized, you know, there's cell phones in this movie.
Uh-huh. He calls Eric Stoltz on one, yeah.
But there's no iPhones. There's no, like, when Mia and Vince go to Jackrabbit Slim's, by all accounts in today's society, at one point or another, one of them is going to take a phone out.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen in that scene, but you don't care. You don't even you don't even think about it. You're probably thinking about it now because I'm mentioning it. But yeah, like, otherwise, you don't even care. You're not even thinking about that. But we've made texting and checking social media and email into this, like, you know, nail-biting habit that never goes away. And, you know, you see a movie where people aren't doing that and you're kind of like, you know, I don't think that we typically want to see those things, but that's just kind of the reality, right? That's where it takes you into a modern time frame. But with Pulp Fiction, you're just never quite sure. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no technology in the film that stands out as, oh, well, this places it in that time frame, or this places it in that time frame. The cars are all like classic or older cars, right? But you still feel like it's a modern society. The movies that are playing on TV are older movies. And just a lot of the different sequences are borrowed or feel like they could just be from any kind of era. When they go into, I just watched when they go into the pawn shop, all the stuff they're selling are like tape decks and record players, you know? So, you know, there's different ways that you can approach this movie in terms of trying to placing it into a specific time frame, but I just kind of consider it in Tarantino land.
Yeah.
Like, this universe of Tarantino movies is where it takes place, which is kind of like this timeless, like, bubble that's kind of a recycling of 70s, 60s, and even some 80s movies kind of mixed together. Because that's what Tarantino has ultimately done. You know, he's a child of cinema
mm-hmm.
and loves movies and has a passion for them. And he loves those, you know, those, the B-side movies, right? From all those different eras. And that's what he's made a career out of doing, is kind of repackaging them.
Yeah.
In the best possible way. He's put his own spin on it, But essentially, he's repackaging it, and he addresses that, you know, multiple times. He says, "Yeah, you know, absolutely, this is meant to be like this or meant to be like that," but with his signature. So, and I think Pulp Fiction is absolutely one of those movies. Like, it's got hints of all different types of movies. It's definitely got kind of this. To me, it has kind of a '70s vibe, but I don't ever think, "Oh, this is a movie set in the '70s." It just has that kind of vibe to it, you know, like a late '70s kind of weird, dark thriller.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of what I pulled from it.
Yeah. I think that was, and I talked about this, I think, on a previous episode, but you know, one of the exciting things about film in the early 90s, you know, that sort of new indie explosion was, it was sort of a return to a 70s sort of, you know, idea of filmmaking, and the director becoming more important and taking the reins back from the producers. And you could argue that the 80s was really sort of a producer driven decade. So
The Simpson-Bruckheimer era.
Yeah. Or Joel Silver. I mean, you were going to see a movie Joel Silver produced it, not because John McTiernan was directing it.
Well, I go to see for
John. bad example, but you know, I don't think anybody sees, you know, Predator saying, "Oh my God, you know, I can't wait to see this," because it, you know.
Yeah. No, I know what you're saying. John McTiernan, my recognition of him came much later, before I really knew about directors. But once I found out the movies that McTiernan had directed, I was like, "Holy crap, this is my favorite director of all time."
Well, I don't think you can underestimate his sort of impact on action movies. I don't think action movies, as we know them today, would be the same without, you know, John McTiernan. I mean, you can just offer up Predator, or more importantly, Die Hard. I mean, Die Hard set a template that is still being used today.
Yeah. Well, and in my opinion, I mean, Die Hard is actually my all-time favorite movie. I've not seen an action movie better than Die Hard. And I know people would argue me to the hilt on that, but I just haven't. That has that impact, that has like the style, the everything, the characters, the pacing. To me, it's a perfect action film, like just a perfect action. There's great action films. There's action films I absolutely love. I just haven't seen one better than Die Hard. And for me, in my opinion, and I just think it is an absolute work of art. I think a lot of people were like, "Oh, that's just like some action movie with Bruce Willis." I'm like, well, it's a little more than that. You go, it's pretty much on everybody's best of, you know, list of movies ever made. You know, it's a tough one to break away from.
Oh, no, absolutely. And I won't disagree with you. I actually have another podcast that is kind of stagnant at the moment, but called Big Screen Book Club. And every episode of that, we read a book or a short story, and then we go watch the movie that it's based on. And Die Hard is based on a book called Nothing Lasts Forever.
Yep. By Roderick Thorpe. I have it. I have the book.
Or I have it on Kindle. So that's the first episode of Big Screen Book Club.
Nice.
Nothing Lasts Forever is a book that I've read multiple times. I can't say that for many books. And I got to say that Die Hard is a perfect movie, and Nothing Lasts Forever is a really sort of cool alternate companion book, because
there's
passages that are like directly from the book that are in the movie,
but
you know, the character's completely different. But if you haven't read that book, I would really, I mean, you have, I'm talking to the listener here.
Sure.
And it's available on Kindle. It's a really good read. And I think Thorpe, you know, the theme that he hit on in that, you know, especially, you know, the character is much older in the book.
Much older.
And, you know, this, you know, sort of, you know, the idea of this old man killing, you know, what are basically kids, you know, in the terrorists. There were a lot of really good passages in that book that really stuck with me. And also, if you're interested, the episode of Big Screen Book Club is out there. And also, we did the follow-up. Die Hard 2 was based on a book called 58 Minutes.
Yep. I have not read that, but I'm aware of it.
Yeah. And then Die Hard 3 was a spec script. And then Live Free or Die Hard was actually based on a magazine article that was in Wired. And back in the spring, I spoke with John Carlin, who was the gentleman who wrote that article. And that's a really fun episode, because we go sort of through his development of it. And it was originally developed in the early 2000s, I think pre 9/11, it was going to be WW3, I believe, was the title of it. And then 9/11 happened and the landscape changed. And then he got a phone call one day that they were turning his script, or, you know, the article that inspired the script, into a Die Hard movie. So it's wild, the history all those Die Hard movies have. But
yeah,
goodness, I don't even know how we worked our way here. But
That's an easy, that's an easy tangent to go on though.
That's what I love about this show, Paul. So we're getting towards the end of things here. Is there any kind of, you know, final thought you want to share about Pulp Fiction?
You know, I just think that it is such a rewarding film to revisit. And I can't say that for every film. I had an argument, or I've had this argument with some people in the past about, you know, you see movies all the time, right? You'll see a movie and you'll be like, wow, that was a really good, powerful movie, very well made. I don't ever need to see it again.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen so many movies like that where I'm just like, yeah, it was good. You know, and it's usually like the movie that wins Best Picture every year. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, it was good. I don't ever need to see it again. Pulp Fiction is a movie I watch probably twice. I'm at a minimum, I would say twice a year. It's probably more than that because it is like it's cinematic comfort food in the mm-hmm. best possible way. It's nutritious comfort food. It really is. It's just rewarding. And there's never a time that I've watched it and not just been like, damn, that was great. I've never gotten to the end of Pulp Fiction and been like, that's just not aging as well. Every time I'm just like, this is just an amazing, it's a perfect movie.
Uh-huh.
I think if it were released today, just given the current political climate, and I don't even mean politics like politicians, I just mean people in general on social media, I think you would probably be canceled. You know, there's like a lot of things in it that I think people just want to cherry pick and clutch their pearls over. But in the end, that is what I love about Tarantino. He doesn't give a shit.
Yeah.
That's what I love about him as an individual is that Tarantino is like, I'm going to put whatever I want to put in my movie to make it genuine. It's my story. I'll use racial slurs. I'll use extreme violence. I'll use sex and nudity. I'll use a woman getting strangled. I'll kill Hitler. I'll do whatever I want.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it should be. You know, you could criticize him. Of course, everybody, if you make something, you're open to criticism. But what I love about Tarantino, and it starts with movies like Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, is that they are unequivocally him.
Right.
You know, he puts all of it on the screen and he doesn't hold back. And I appreciate that. And I don't love every single Tarantino film the same. I like all of his films for sure. I love most of them. There's mm-hmm. a few that kind of stand out where I'm just like, it didn't work as much for me or didn't work as well. The Hateful Eight is one of those. Mm-hmm. It's just, I appreciate it. I just don't love it. But I love the fact that he sticks to his guns. And Pulp Fiction was kind of like the fact that he did that with Pulp Fiction and hasn't stopped since is just awesome. So it's a classic.
That is really, really well said, Paul. Thank you for that. And not to get onto a whole nother tangent here, but I think for me, I sort of reignited my love of Tarantino was with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I think it's a real sort yeah. of, I'd call it like a cousin of Pulp Fiction. And I think there was a time where I think, and it might be around the time that, you know, Sally Menke died, but I think there was a point where Tarantino didn't have an editor that could tell him, you know, that he was possibly including stuff that he didn't need to include. And I think, you know, there's certain films that are a little, you know, that probably would have turned out better had Sally, you know, lived to work on them.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely, I think that's one of his biggest problems there is he doesn't know how to really kill his darlings. So on one hand, I'm championing the fact that he doesn't kill his darlings, but then sometimes, you know, a couple of them probably needed to be put out to pasture, but in the end, he's just genuine.
And yeah, no, he's a unique filmmaker. And that's why I love him as well. It's, you know, just like John Carpenter, if you turn on a Tarantino movie, you know, it's a Tarantino movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I just watched a bunch of Carpenter movies recently. So he's another one I can revisit regularly.
I got to say there was a run probably from Halloween through They Live where you can argue that no other filmmaker had, you know, back to back movies that were as good as the ones Carpenter made in that like 8 to 9 year period.
Window. Yeah. Really, some really great classics in that window for sure.
Yeah. I mean, the dude that made Halloween, which, you know, is, you know, a historic, you know, landmark horror film, you know, also made The Thing, which is a, you know, a sort of a sci-fi horror masterpiece. Yeah. I mean, yep. Any filmmaker would love to make one of those films, and Carpenter did it over and over again. I mean, and then you've got sort of the grindhouse sort of, you know, feel of like Escape from New York. It's amazing. I could talk about John Carpenter with people all day. He's probably my all-time favorite filmmaker behind Tarantino.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great. Yeah. I mean, he's a treasure, man. He's a legend.
And now he's making kick-ass music too.
Yeah. I really like his, I have a couple of his individual music things that he's done, which I really like. So
yeah,
he's awesome. And he's done some great, a lot of his compositions are great. They don't get enough appreciation. I just recently watched Escape from New York and I'm always reminded like, man, this really is just such a great theme. It's awesome.
I was thinking that the other day because he put out, I think it was like an EP he put out. It was like he redid four of his classic themes, and Escape from New York was one of them. And I was thinking it's such a iconic theme. And the fact that, you know, he wrote and directed a movie and then he's like, oh, I'm going to score it now too. Like, who wants to do all that work? It's amazing.
Yeah.
So, Paul, again, this was really, really great. I had a great time chatting with you, and hopefully in the future we find a way to sit down and chat again because it was really enjoyable. And I will include a link to the network on YouTube as well as your Twitter handle. And once again, thank you so much, Paul, for sitting down and chatting Pulp Fiction with me.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I appreciate you inviting me on. And again, that's what I enjoy. I love talking movies with like-minded people. So appreciate you inviting me on and had a great time.
All right. Excellent. And we'll chat next time.